It's the Amazing Rico Bronya Podcast with your host, Evan Roberts.
It is indeed a brand new edition of Rico Bronya, episode number 489. Damn, we are working our way to the big 500. Can you very quickly name the only person to hit their 500th home run as a New York Met? The answer to that trivia question is Gary Sheffield in one of the most unmemorable accomplishments in Mets history. Gary Sheffield was an excellent baseball player, but this was long before he was a New York Met. And then he randomly hit his 500th home run on a Friday night at Citi Field. But we are fast approaching episode number 500 of Rico Bronya. This is going to be a busy Rico. We will recap all three games of the series against the Chicago White Sox. We will certainly look ahead. We will hear from Carlos Mendoza concerning the latest Juan Soto batting slump, and a lot more. We'll get into Andy Martino's hatred of Jacob deGrom. That's later as well. So very, very busy edition of Rico Bronya. Let me start with a little state of the team, and then we'll go through these games. The Mets won 2 out of 3. They won a series. I know that when you play a team as crappy as the Chicago White Sox, a team coming off of a historically bad year a year ago, a team that came into this series at 17-36, you look at a series like this and say, boy, you better win all three games. It is very difficult in this sport to win every single day. So when you play a team like Chicago and Colorado, which is coming up shortly, while it would be great to just rile up victories against everybody, you got to at least win the series. And to the Mets' credit, despite how ugly the finale of the series was, and despite how ugly a lot of the games were, which we're about to get into, they won 2 out of 3. So I will start with that positive, because sometimes we get lost in the, well, the White Sox suck, you should win every single day. It's very difficult to win every single day. I use our friends, the New York Yankees, who have played great baseball now for a while. They won 2 out of 3 against Colorado. It was not easy, but they won a series. And we have a few more series like that where the Mets are facing bad teams. And obviously, you don't want to lose a series to a bad team. That would be a disaster. We would come on the Rico Bronya and be very critical. But you want to win a series. So it sucks the way it ended. It sucked watching the Mets give up a season-high 9 runs to an offense that came in, averaging 3.4 runs per game. But nevertheless, as we delve deep into this three-game series, let's start with the headline, which is the Mets won 2 out of 3. Now let's go to the first game of this series back on Memorial Day. It was a very nice crowd, very nice day out at Citi Field. I took the family. I battled through numerous child, basically, what do they do again when they freak out? Freakouts, you know, child freakouts. I had my youngest son freaking out that he didn't give the digital ticket to the ticket taker, and my oldest son did. That was freak out number one. Freak out number two was, I want chocolate ice cream right now. I said, Spence, can we wait till the fourth inning? Freak out number two. But battling those freakouts, we did see the New York Mets play what was a very pretty game and an ugly game at the same time. Let me start with the pretty. The Met defense on Monday afternoon against the Chicago White Sox deserves the old gold star. From Pete Alonso's diving play in the first inning to Francisco Lindor making a nifty play in the third inning to a really good defensive play, probably the best one made by Jeff McNeil to start the sixth inning, that headlong dive to another great play by Pete Alonso to Brandon Nimmo running into the left field corner and making a great running catch. The Met defense in this game against the White Sox was stupendous, and they were going to need it because the offense did nothing. If the hope was the Mets winning 2 out of 3 against LA would somehow garner in this offense living up to its expectations and breaking through and getting big hits, well, we were dead wrong. And the worst part about Monday is they weren't just shut down by some random crappy pitcher. They were shut down by Adrian Hauser. Adrian Hauser, a guy, one of the rare, I guess, misfires by David Stearns. David Stearns has hit the jackpot in almost every move he's made. And that trade he made, the Adrian Hauser trade, looks like a good one because Tyrone Taylor came in it. And Tyrone Taylor has been a very useful piece on this team. But Adrian Houser was a mess, especially with the pitching lab. And you think to yourself, well, if Adrian Houser can't make it work with the pitching lab, he's certainly not going to make it work with the Chicago White Sox. And yet twirled six scoreless innings and pitched into the seventh inning. I mean, it really was. It was a great performance by Houser. And outside of the one-out double by Brandon Nimmo in the first inning, it's not like the Mets had a million opportunities against him. They were just shut down. So I'm sitting there at Citi Field. Maybe you're sitting there on your deck at home or listening to the radio or watching the game, or maybe you went to Citi Field too. And this game, which was 1-0 Chicago after they got a sacrifice fly by Andrew Benintendi, this game felt like a slow death because they were getting shut out by Adrian Houser. And we can't even typically bitch about the lack of big hits. It was the lack of any hits. They had one hit against Houser going into the sixth inning. And finally, Francisco Lindor got a two-out single, and Brandon Nimmo struck out. They put a rally together against Houser in the seventh inning that knocked him out of the game. Juan Soto drew a walk. Pete Alonso had that base hit to right field. And they're set up with two on and nobody out in a 1-0 game in the bottom of the seventh inning. And that's when we got our taste of being unable to get the big hit. You saw Will Venable do something that was pretty obvious how Mendy was going to react. Venable went to a lefty to face Jared Young, who has been in the lineup quite a bit lately. More on that in a little bit. And the counter was Starling Marte, which was obvious. I mean, you almost knew if you're Will Venable, if I'm going to a lefty, it's really to go after Beatty two batters later, because I know they're going to pinch hit Jared Young with Starling Marte. Marte grounds out, Beatty grounds out, Taylor draws a walk, and then you've got this Jeff McNeil at bat with the bases loaded, two outs, bottom of the seventh inning, down 1-0. Shockingly enough, I actually had more confidence in Jeff McNeil than the strikeout looking. I figured he was just going to pop up the short center field on the first pitch. That was my initial prediction as I sat there with both my boys, my dad, my wife came. It was a family affair on Memorial Day at Citi Field. I figured Jeff McNeil, first pitch, little pop up the short center field. And instead he strikes out looking. And here we are watching this Met offense get shut down, not just by Adrian Houser, but by Brandon Eichert. I mean, they couldn't lose this game. That's what I kept telling myself. They can't possibly lose this game. They're going to scratch out a run by accident. And look, credit to Clay Holmes, who walked three guys, pitched into the sixth inning, had to dance out a lot of trouble in this game. And like we talked about, was helped out by some really, really good Met defense. But he pitches into the sixth inning. He only allows the one run, which was the sacrifice fly to Andrew Benintendi in the fourth inning. Jose Buteau, who's been very spotty this year, comes in a tough spot. They go to Buteau with bases loaded, two out in the sixth inning. And I want to go through that in terms of how Mendy handled that sixth inning. So Clay Holmes gets through five. I totally get why you're trying to squeeze a sixth inning out of him. McNeil makes that great diving play we talked about to start the sixth inning. He gets Miguel Vargas out. So there's two outs and nobody on, and it feels like, wow, all right, Clay's going to get through six. Not bad. He gives up an infield hit to Benintendi on a play Pete Alonso probably should have made, I guess, a rare defensive miscue. He gives up an infield hit to Luis Robert, and he's still in the game. And I guess the thought being he gave up infield hits. A lot of it bad luck. This is so typical of Clay Holmes. Once he walks Palacios to load up the bases, that's when it becomes easy to get him out. The problem is you're taking him out, and you're going to Jose Buteau with the bases loaded in a 1-0 game. And with the way this offense was struggling, Jose Buteau makes one bad pitch to this Edgar Cuero. Things are going to get very ugly. But credit to the Met bullpen, and this would be kind of a story in game one, and really a story throughout this series, bailing the guy before him out, stranding the inherited runners, which is such an important, underrated stat that really no one looks at. Like, you never see that stat anywhere. But stranding inherited runners, and Buteau got Cuero to ground out and strand not one, not two, but three base runners left by Clay Holmes. And then Buteau walks a guy in the seventh inning, not just a guy. He walks the ninth place hitter, Josh Rojas, on four pitches. And then we get Waskar Brazoban, who strands a base runner helped out by some really good defense by Pete Alonso. Then Brazoban puts a guy on base, and then Jose Castillo comes in with a runner on and two outs. And after losing Slater on an 11-pitch walk, which was not easy, strikes out Cuero to get through the eighth inning. So the Met bullpen is doing everything you could ask. They are keeping this game close for this Met offense to finally wake up against Adrian Hauser and the White Sox bullpen. And it did in the eighth inning. It was not easy. And let's start with the real hero of that eighth inning. The hero of that eighth inning was a guy that we need to see start hitting. We need to see signs from this guy. And that's Francisco Alvarez. We talked about it on the last Rico. Playing time is going to start to go away. Like, he is not going to be just guaranteed playing time. Luis Torrens has played incredibly well. And at some point, you're going to see Carlos Mendoza start to play Torrens more, which we've slowly started. Francisco Alvarez's leadoff base hit in the eighth inning was pivotal. Lindor would cite this after the game as a big moment in the game, and he's right. It allows them to go to Acuna to pinch run, and then it's set up really by Brandon Nimmo's big base hit. Brandon hit one down the right field line, allowed Acuna, who flies, to go first to third, and it set up a Juan Soto moment. And I had a funny exchange with my wife at this game because Juan Soto at this point was 0 for 2 with a walk. And my wife, who does not know much about sports, but she's very supportive, looks at me and says, wow, Juan Soto's ERA is terrible. And I'm like, ERA? Oh, you must mean average or OPS. And she's like, yeah, he's having a bad year. Now, you would think, well, does my wife know by listening to the Rico Bronya or WFAN? Not really. She looked at whatever stat she was looking at, let's say OPS, and deciphered that that was bad. So I got great commentary from my wife. Soto's having a bad year based on his bad ERA. This was such a huge spot for Juan because in the eighth inning, with first and third one out, down 1-0, you got to drive this run in. And that was my thought at the time. You got to drive. At the bare minimum, Juan, hit your little cheap little roller to first base and score Acuna, who runs like the wind. Now, Soto did a little bit better. He hit an average fly ball to left field. And if it wasn't for Luis Angel Acuna being lightning fast, I don't know if the base runner even tries to tie the game or if they're thrown out at the plate. So Juan Soto is bailed out by Luis Angel Acuna being really fast to tie the game up. Otherwise, he was really going to hear it. I mean, if that's a fly ball that's a little bit shorter, or like I said, there's a different base runner and the run doesn't score, Juan's going to hear it from Met fans. Luckily, Acuna scores, and luckily this game is tied at one. And once they tied the game, I don't know about you, I felt a little bit more comfortable about, all right, they're going to eventually win this game. The White Sox can't score a damn run. We will just, by hook or by crook, we'll get a run across. I'm hoping it's not in the 13th inning. I'm hoping we're not going to have to sweat out a very long game like we did Friday night against the Dodgers, a game they ended up losing. Because at this point, I'm thinking, I'm looking at my kids, and I'm like, are we gonna make through 11 or 12 innings? I could try. I think Jed will be able to do it. But what about my little guy? What about my wife? And the Mets had that opportunity in the eighth inning. Brett Beatty hit one on the screws, just unfortunately right at Mike Tauchman in right field. And then it was all set up in the ninth inning. Again, the underrated base hit was Tyrone Taylor's double. A base hit by Torrens when he was looking to bunt with first and second, nobody out, after McNeil got intentionally walked. And then bases loaded, nobody out, with Lindor coming up. I'm not a cocky Met fan. I don't even know if I'm an optimistic Met fan. I guess that's up to the listeners to determine. I've been called everything. There are some Met fans who think I'm way too optimistic. There are plenty of Met fans who think I'm very negative. So I leave that up to you, whatever you think I am. But once the bases were loaded with nobody out in the ninth inning with Lindor coming up, even though Lindor has been in this major funk, you knew the game was over. At least I knew the game was over. I was confident the game was over. And luckily, Lindor ended it swinging at the first pitch, hitting one in deep right field. Who cares if it gets out? It didn't go out. Luckily, it ends the freaking game. And the Mets escape. Because that would have been, look, I think any loss sucks when you're a diehard fan, but losing that game on Memorial Day, getting shut down by Adrian Hauser, having an offense do nothing, wasting good pitching from Clay Holmes in the Met bullpen, that would have been a stinger. And luckily, they survive. They win the game on two sacrifice flies. They finish 1-for-7 with runners in scoring position. The only hit with runners in scoring position was that Luis Torrens hit in the ninth inning. Edwin Diaz did a hell of a job. He did issue a 4-pitch walk to Chase Madroff, but then got through it by striking out Mike Tauchman. Wonderful effort by the Met bullpen. A solid effort by Clay Holmes. I give him a B. You pitch into the sixth inning, you only allow one run. That's a B performance. Great effort by the Met defense, like we talked about. It was just the offense did nothing. But luckily, they woke up and delivered when they needed it by getting that tying run in the eighth inning and the winning run in the ninth inning. And underrated offensive moments. Alvarez with the base hit to start the rally in the eighth, and Tyrone Taylor to rally or start the rally in the ninth inning. What I couldn't believe when I got to Citi Field and I was checking out the starting lineup was, all right, Jared Young playing again. Okay, fine. You want to see what the kid's got. I don't love it, but sure. Jared Young batting fifth? I don't know about that, Mindy. Batting fifth? Pete Alonso has had some of the worst protection over the last bunch of years since he's become a Met. We did an offseason Rico Bronya discussing that. You can go back into the archives to check it out. Just search Pete Alonso protection. I'm sure it'll be there. He's had some garbage protection over the years, and you're telling me you're putting Jared Young, who I know has had some good numbers in the minor leagues, you're putting Jared Young as the fifth place hitter to protect Pete Alonso? Did not love it. As far as game two was concerned, when Tylor Megill, who, listen, big performance by Tylor Megill. You're facing a crappy White Sox offense. You're trying to build off of an encouraging last start after you put together three bad starts in a row, and Tylor Megill gives up a two-run home run to Miguel Vargas. Not a good sign. And considering the Met offense only scored two runs the night before, we're not exactly brimming with confidence that the Mets are going to answer by scoring a lot of runs here. Now, I had quite an experience getting to this game. Usually when I go to Met games during the week, I take the LIRR from work in New York City, take the train up to Penn Station, take the LIRR, it pulls in at 6:55. I'm usually in my seat right as first pitch is starting at 7:10. For whatever reason, on Tuesday, game two of this series, the subways were running incredibly slow. Don't know why. And because of that, there was no way I was going to make that LIRR train. So I did your traditional thing. I took the 7. But the 7 is not as quick as the Long Island Railroad. So I'm taking the 7. I show up in the bottom of the first inning, which I hate, but I've been able at my older age to just remind myself, Evan, it's not a big deal. Okay. You will insert the scorecard later. You can always go on the MLB Game Day app. I did watch the top of the first inning. You just put it in, everything will be fine. So I saw the Miguel Vargas two-run home run on my phone while walking towards Citi Field. I think I had just pulled in. I think the 7 train just let me out. I'm walking with the hordes of people downstairs, getting ready to go in the ballpark. I see Vargas hit a two-run home run. And my thought is this. As bad as the Met offense is, you're allowed to have a day in which you score a bunch of runs. Even bad offenses will have their good days. And what the Mets proceeded to do, which I didn't see coming, was to have batting practice in the bottom of the first inning against Jonathan Cannon and then do nothing after that. And I don't want to bitch because the Mets ended up winning the game, obviously. They go down 2-0. They score 4 in the bottom of the first inning. They tack on 1 in the third, 1 in the eighth. They win the game 6-2 or 6-4. But I thought when the Mets scored the 4 in the first with the 2 home runs, Pete Alonso 2-run home run, Jared Young 2-run home run, I thought, all right, we're going to get ourselves an offensive orgy. We're going to get a big breakout. It didn't happen. Not the end of the world because they did score enough runs to win. But I really thought that first inning in which they were just pounding Jonathan Cannon. Oh, my God, did they rip him up. Think about that first inning. Nimmo infield hit. Soto hits the ball up the alley. I'll get to that play in a second. Pete, 2-run home run. Beatty, base hit. Young, 2-run home run. Base hit Vientos. Base hit McNeil. Hit batsman. And then, unfortunately, Francisco Lindor took an 0-for-2 in that first inning by grounding out and leaving the bases loaded. But a great response by the Met offense, considering Megill had the hiccup by giving up the 2-run home run to Vargas. the bats responded. Now let's get to the Soto play. There will be plenty of Juan Soto discussion here on episode 49 of the Rico, specifically the fact that he's not hitting, that his numbers right now are horrible. And I'm sure you've received text messages from your friends who are Yankee fans telling you that Aaron Judge has a higher slugging percentage than Juan Soto. I'm sorry, Aaron Judge has a higher batting average than Juan Soto has slugging percentage. That Aaron Judge has a higher slugging percentage than Juan Soto has OPS. And then Anthony Volpe has a better year than Juan Soto. And Ben Rice is better than Juan Soto. And I'm sure you've heard it. And the truth is, none of that matters. What matters is he hasn't been good. But in the first inning of game two of this series, he jumped on the first pitch by Jonathan Cannon. He ripped it up the alley in right center field. And have you ever seen a slow motion car crash? I haven't, but I've heard that analogy used. Like you see something in slow motion. Maybe it's your kid tripping. Like you can see it happening from a mile away and you run over and you're screaming, but it's way too late. And then he fell on his ass. When Soto hits this ball up the alley, and I had just sat down in my seat, feeling good, glad I'm finally here. As Soto rips it and the crowd's doing it on, I'm watching Nimmo. And I see Brandon Nimmo running backwards. And now I'm screaming like I can make a difference. Like, go, go, what are you doing? And as this is happening, I see Soto, who clearly doesn't see Nimmo, and he's just running past him. This faux pas, which luckily turned out to not be a big deal because Pete hit the two-run home run right after, and then Jared Young hit a two-run home run. And like I mentioned, the Mets scored enough runs to win this game 6-4. But as this is happening, I'm like, are you kidding me? Juan Soto, who has slumped after we thought he was getting out of his slump with the big hit against Los Angeles, he rips one up the alley, and now we're going to end up with Brandon Nimmo running himself out of the inning. So it was a slow motion car crash. It was all Brandon Nimmo's fault. I mean, if we're assigning blame here, Juan Soto couldn't have done anything differently, because even if he stops because he sees Nimmo's running back, Nimmo's still running back to first base. Like, nothing's going to change the fact that there's going to be a runner on first base with one out, or two outs, I should say. Like, nothing's going to change that. So Soto didn't do anything wrong. Nimmo did. I don't even think the umpires did anything wrong, because I thought it was clear as day that they ruled the safe sign, which is the ball was trapped by Michael A. Taylor. So Brandon Nimmo just effed up. Now, what makes matters worse in this whole conversation, yes, it ended up being fine because, like I mentioned, Pete hits a home run, Young hits a home run, the Mets end up scoring four runs on a bunch of hits in the first inning. What I could not get over is that Juan Soto doesn't get a hit. I can't get over that. And I sat there for a few innings debating with my dad. I mean, we weren't debating because I think he agreed with me, which is, how come the scoreboard doesn't have a base hit up for Juan Soto? This does not make any sense. And I'm doing my research like, no. Like, I know my guess was, here's my guess on the way this thing should be scored. It's a base hit for Soto. It's only a single, and he's out three unassisted only because the first baseman is the closest person to him. So Miguel Vargas would get the put out. So it's a single, and then he's out three unassisted. That's what makes sense. But I'm watching the scoreboard, and they're not giving him a hit. Then when Soto came up in the second inning, it lists it as, oh, what? No, hold on. Before I jump to that, then they gave him a hit. I'm like, okay, good. See, I'm right. Of course it's a base hit. How is it not a base hit? And then when Soto came up, I guess it was the fourth inning then, he's listed as 0-for-2, and that base hit isn't a base hit. It's three unassisted. And I'm like, what? Three unassisted? My ass. That's a base hit up the alley. Yes, he's out three unassisted, if you want to say that. But it's a base hit. Now I listen to Gary, Keith, and Ron. I didn't hear their full explanation on the scoring, but I heard them kind of recapping the play. What I have found out, and I still disagree with this, is that because Nimmo didn't get the second base and Nimmo went back to first base, and Soto can't get a base hit. How could he get a base hit if the base runner has to go back to the bag? So that's the explanation. Now, my issue with that is, well, hold on. If Soto hits a line drive off of Brandon Nimmo's head, Nimmo's out, Soto gets a base hit. That's not disputing it. That's the fact. That's how it works when a ball hits a base runner. The base runner's out, the batter gets a hit. So if we're okay giving a base hit to a batter that hits a runner, how the F are we not giving a base hit to Juan Soto just because Brandon Nimmo had to go back to first base? I don't get it. So my scorebook right now is still kind of empty. I actually left the Soto spot empty outside of the direction of the ball because I am protesting this. I don't think the rule makes any sense. I don't think the official scoring makes any sense. Juan Soto should have a base hit. Now, for any Yankee fan listening, saying, oh my God, look at this desperate Met fan. He's begging for a Juan Soto base hit as opposed to him being 0 for his last 17. This has nothing to do with Juan Soto. Nothing. This could have been any other guy on the Mets. I'd be screaming the same thing because it doesn't make sense logically. He doesn't get a base hit for hitting one up the right field, right center field alley? No. I don't agree. So it is officially an out for Soto, but I'm telling you right now, I'm taking this to the highest levels of our land. Do not be surprised if this goes to the Supreme Court.
Well, you keep on saying a couple things that are aggravating me. You keep on saying Nimmo had to go back to first base. He didn't have to. He
I didn't say he had to go back to first base. He's an idiot. He screwed up the play.
Well, right. No, exactly.
But you didn't say he had to go back to first base. What am I saying that?
Well, you keep on saying that. You say, well, you whatever. Whatever the point is, he made a mistake and thought he had to go back.
Yes, he screwed up. This is all on Brandon Nimmo. I am not disputing that.
Right. So, and here's the other thing too, right? When someone gets a base hit, Pete Alonso or Juan Soto watches the ball a little bit, then it hits the wall, and they try to run out and get a double out of it, and he's out. Technically, that's a base hit, even though he gets thrown out of second base, but he's out. Yeah. So, like, if that's a base hit, why wouldn't the Soto thing be a base
hit? The explanation,
first base.
The explanation is the base runner went back to first base, and that negates Soto getting a base hit. Nimmo didn't, even though Nimmo passed second base, and then he rounded back. Because he ended up going back to first base, that's the reason Soto doesn't get a hit. I don't agree with this. Don't make me argue the wrong side.
No, I'm not trying to make you argue. I'm just confused. I'm pissed because Nimmo's an idiot that Soto suffers, is basically what we're trying to say.
Well, what makes it worse, okay, besides take my geekiness away and the way it should be scored and just the nature of scoring games that bothers me, it also adds to the Soto slump. Look, Juan Soto didn't get a hit technically in this Chicago series, even though he did get a hit in the Chicago series. And now he's going through this painful offer. So I think it, because it is Soto and he is obviously going to be the lightning rod around here, that's what makes it worse. And my calculations going back to the Dodgers series, look at my scorecard to confirm this, is that the last time Juan Soto got a base hit was the RBI double, the two-run double in the fourth inning of the Dodgers series that was eventually the game-winning RBIs, gave the Mets the 4-2 lead. They won 5-2. He went 0-2 in his last two at-bats on that Saturday. He went 0-4 on Sunday. He went 0-2 in game one of this series with a walk and a sac fly. Technically, he's 0-4 in game two of this series. It should have been 1-4, and he took an 0-4 in the finale. So my math has it as 0 for his last 16 or 0 for his last 17, which is just unbelievable. It's unbelievable that Soto is dealing with this. And a lot of it is bad luck. I admit that. But a lot of it is he's hitting just weak ground balls to second base and weak ground balls to first base. Luckily, this wasn't a big deal in game two because, again, they scored their runs. They got the 4 runs in the first inning. They tacked on an important run in the third inning on a sacrifice fly by Jeff McNeil. And they tacked on another run in the eighth inning on an RBI hit by Lindor behind in the count. And that was a big one because remember the White Sox rallied. Let's put a bow on game two, and then we'll get more into Soto and what happened in the finale of this series. McGill, after giving up the 2-run home run in the first inning, really settled down, pitched well. And then Mendy gave him every shot to get through that sixth inning. similar to what we talked about with Clay Holmes in game one. McGill gives up a leadoff hit in the sixth, gets back-to-back strikeouts on Vargas and Benintendi, and then walks Cuero. Mendy goes out, speaks to McGill, says, "What do you think? Can you get me through this sixth inning?" And what does he do? He walks Palacios. So he issues the back-to-back walks. Again, you see Mendy relying on Jose Buteau to clean up a mess with the bases loaded and two outs. Remember, Jose Buteau came in a night earlier with the bases loaded and two out and got the big ground out. In this case, he gets Sosa to hit one to center field, and luckily Jeff McNeil makes a nice running catch. As McNeil was running after this baseball, I am saying out loud, "That's McNeil! That's McNeil!" Almost like I'm not expecting Jeff McNeil to make that play. Now, Jose Buteau is in line to be your Rico I'm the Man Now star of the series. If you think about it, gets out of a bases loaded jam in game one, gets out of a bases loaded jam in game two. The problem is, in the seventh inning, in which he came back out with a 5-2 lead, he puts a couple of guys on base. He gives up an RBI double to Miguel Vargas, and he allows this game to tighten up and make it a 5-4 game. So unfortunately for Buteau, despite the big pitches that he made, I'll say this right now, it was getting there that Buteau was a legit candidate for the Rico I'm the Man Now star of the series, but you can't do that. You can't let a 5-2 game become 5-4 and then have your mess cleaned up by Jose Castillo to be the Rico I'm the Man Now star of the series. Can't happen. But great job by Castillo and great job by Reed Garrett, because Edwin Diaz was clearly not going to be available in this game. And so Carlos Mendoza asked Garrett to get the two outs in the eighth inning with a runner on first and one out. He does it by striking out Robert, by striking out Taylor, and then he pitches a clean ninth inning right after Lindor gave him the insurance. So another overall good job by the Met bullpen. Even though Buteau gave up the two runs, Buteau made the big out to strand the bases loaded. Castillo made the big pitches to strand the tying run on second base. And Reed Garrett does a great job stranding the tying run on first base and collecting the five-out save. The negative is the offense. The negative is after they score the four in the first inning and Jonathan Cannon looks like he's not long for the world, the Mets really aren't able to pile on. Now, as far as the finale is concerned, game three of this series was a disaster. Number one, it gets moved from nighttime to daytime, which turned out to be a great decision in terms of getting the game in because the weather has been awful on Wednesday night. So from that standpoint, yeah, the Mets did something smart. And I think there's two ways you can look at moving games because of weather. If it's all about just getting the game in, if that's the priority, if it's not about convenience for fans, it's just, hey, we got to get this game in, then clearly the Mets made the right call. But you could see by the lack of people in the building, you're basically telling 80% of the people that have tickets, go use the vouchers for a future game because you ain't coming to this. And a good job by the Mets allowing that, by allowing anyone who had tickets to Wednesday's game to trade it in for another game. But you do ruin anyone who is planning on going to a Wednesday night game. Now, the counter to that is they weren't going to play Wednesday night anyway because the weather was terrible. So it's a double-edged sword when it comes to moving these games. Obviously, it worked in terms of getting the game in. It just sucked because it was played in front of an empty building. And the Mets performed like it was in front of an empty building. Everything about this game sucked. You'll want to start with the fact that Griffin Canning had zero command and his fastball velocity was down. We can start there. Set the tone for the game, giving up a double early to Miguel Vargas. Miguel Vargas with another first inning impact. We could talk about how bad the defense was. As great as the defense was early in this series, Brett Beatty making a throwing error. Brett Beatty looking shaky at third base. Jeff McNeil looking shaky at second base. And you had a Griffin Canning that just gave you his worst start of the year. So his last start before this was against the Dodgers. That was the 13-inning game. And I said this that night when we did a Rico Bronya. And that was, I got to throw this game out. There was a rain delay. I just, 2 1/3 innings, one hit, 3 runs, 4 walks. It was really 3 walks because remember that 4th walk was him leaving with a 3-1 count to Freddie Freeman. He may have walked Freeman anyway, but it's one of those kind of caveats when you look at stats. I'm not concerned about Cannon because it's two bad starts in a row, because I am going to take that Dodger game and kind of throw it away. But this was a stinker. You can't sugarcoat it. He was bad. What will he do in his next start, which will be against the LA Dodgers, will be a big test. We'll see if he can bounce back. I think there's a skepticism with Canning. Can he keep this up all year? The good news is the Mets have reinforcements coming. Now, I'm not worried yet. Like I said, this was just a bad day at the ballpark. It was a bad day. No command, velocity down. It was just ugly. So ugly pitching by Canning, ugly defense early by Brett Beatty and Jeff McNeil. And then what do you know? The offense can't do dick. Two on, two out. Brett Beatty strikes out in the first. Two on, one out. Tyrone Taylor grounds out. Lindor pops up. They did have two on and nobody out in the third inning. And after Alonso struck out and Beatty grounded out, they got bailed out by Vientos. That was very encouraging. Mark Vientos going opposite field for a three-run home run that turned a 5-0 deficit into a 5-3 game. There are two problems. Number one, they went to Brandon Waddell and said, eat up this baseball game. We do not want to waste our bullpen, even with an off day on Thursday. You are called up for a reason. You haven't pitched yet since the call-up. Go eat five innings. And Waddell did that. He also gave up four runs, so this 5-3 game slowly became 6-3, 7-3, 8-3, 9-3, and they lose 9-4. And then the other thing was the offense. The offense did nothing. They got the three runs by Mark Vientos, and after that, it was your typical no-show performance. They ended up finishing with runners in scoring position, 2-for-12. So in this three-game series against Chicago, the Mets go a combined 4-for-25 with runners in scoring position. This was an awful start, one of the worst starts they've gotten all year. It was also the most runs they have allowed all season long. And you do that against a White Sox team that's averaging less than 3.5 runs per game. Look, I think this is one of those ugly ones that you just have to throw out. You have to say, all right, they won the series. That's the positive. That's ugly. If you were at Citi Field, I feel bad for you. But I think that's one of those, they say you burn the tape in the NFL. You burn the tape. Obviously, the issues with runners in scoring position, that's the problem that's gone on all year. So when you see that continue, that's a worry. But in terms of Griffin Canning, I throw it out. In terms of Brett Beatty's defense, which has mostly been good since he's come back, it's been great, really, since he's come back, I throw that out. You move on. And you say, all right, they won the series. They've won 4 out of 6 on this homestand. Fantastic. Now go beat the Colorado Rockies. Now let's get to Soto. Guy called up at the end of the show I do with Tiki saying, when do you get worried? That's a great question, because based on the emails I'm receiving, there's a lot of worry. There's a lot of people very concerned about Juan Soto. What I will tell you about Juan Soto and my level of concern is I'm less concerned about the long-term nature of this. It's a 15-year contract. He is a great hitter. And great players will tend to show that they're great players. I don't think he's come here and got fat and said, I got my money. I don't care. I don't buy that at all. This is not a Muhammad Wilkerson situation. So in terms of long-term, I'm not worried at all. We saw Carlos Beltran. We saw Francisco Lindor. Like, we've seen guys come here and struggle at first. The problem is, when I say that, we've seen guys have bad years. Like, we've seen a full year of underperformance. So when I say Carlos Beltran or Francisco Lindor, sure, there's a part of you that would say, oh, that's great, Ev. It's good to know that Juan Soto isn't going to be a bust. But what about this season? I'm still believing that Juan Soto is going to break out of it. He may not put up the massive final numbers that he put up last year with the New York Yankees, but he doesn't have to. Just remember this, because I think what bothers some Met fans is the fights that they have with their Yankee fan friends. It is not about his numbers. It is not about if his WAR is better than Anthony Volpe's. It's about helping the team win. Right now, he's not. This is a massive, massive batting slump now for one. This is not like the first month of the year where, you know what? He's making an impact on the lineup. His numbers are not that bad. No, his numbers are bad. His numbers are terrible. He's gone 5 games without a base hit since the double on Saturday. So they need to get him going, because the pitching isn't going to remain this good. Pete's going to cool off. Lindor's already cooled off. That's the thing that, you know, is not getting as much attention, which is the fact that despite the sacrifice fly the other night, despite the RBI single late in game two, Francisco Lindor has gone through a long period of time without hitting. My concern on Soto is if this just continues to build and continues to be a problem, does it become mental? He needs his confidence. And I did see some confidence in the finale of this series. He did do the Soto shuffle. And more so than the Soto shuffle, he stared down a pitcher. He kind of had that swagger back. Eventually, that has to turn into results. Now, Carlos Mendoza is, of course, the manager of this team. And he was asked after the game about Juan Soto. I want you to take a listen to Mendy's answer, and then we'll analyze what Carlos had to say. The question was, hey, are you worried about Juan Soto? Is it going to affect Juan Soto's confidence, which is what I'm alluding to? And here is the exchange and what Carlos Mendoza had to say.
Are you seeing any signs of frustration of him, you know, looking for those results?
I mean, you want to see frustration, especially when a competitor as he is. But honestly, today was one of those days where he didn't hit the ball hard. But I thought that his foundation, his lower half, was in a better position. You know, so that's, for me, that's a good sign. Again, he didn't hit the ball hard today, but there was something today with his lower half that, for me, that was a good sign.
You see him shuffle a couple of times on that walk. Is that encouraging?
Yeah, but it's not the shuffle. You know, I think it's just him in the bat. Again, for me, his lower half was on a better place, even though he didn't hit the ball hard today.
Let's see if Mendy's right. I can't tell you if his lower half is in a better place, but maybe, and I was saying this to Tiki on the air, that Soto's confidence is back. And Mendy doesn't make a big deal out of the shuffle or the staring down the pitcher. Fine. But my reasoning for why Juan wasn't doing that a lot this season was a lack of confidence. Not he's miserable being met like the fan fiction we've heard. Just he doesn't have the swagger because he doesn't believe. If he's starting to believe and have that confidence, even if the results aren't there, that could be a sign that the breakout is coming. And I do believe the breakout is coming. I do. I remember last year, Aaron Judge and Francisco Lindor both got off to terrible starts. And I would sit back and say, they're better than this. You know they're better than this. Juan Soto's better than this. I get why Met fans are pissed. I get why they don't want to hear what Yankee fans are telling them. I get why, hey, all you've done in your career, you've done it for other teams, not with us. Go do it for us. I totally get that. But if we are being rational, if we're trying to be rational, how could you think Juan Soto isn't going to hit? Guy's hit his entire life. This may turn out to be one of Juan Soto's not best seasons in his Hall of Fame career. That's certainly on the table. But the idea that he's going to hit 225 the whole year, if these numbers hold out, like we're at the third part of the season, we're a third of the way through. So if you want to very easily figure out what a guy is on pace to do, times everything by three. Juan Soto is on pace to hit, let's see, 24 home runs and drive in 75 runs. I think he'll do better than that. And I don't think he's going to finish at 228. When will he break out? I certainly hope it's the Colorado Rockies. Fred Solomon writes in the Rico B email, I don't want to harp too much on a series we actually won, but if Soto can't fatten up against the White Sox, when's it going to happen? Since he's being compared to Beltran, would you sign up today for Soto to finish with Beltran's 2005 stats? By the way, I've been looking at Carlos Beltran's 2005 stats. What I didn't remember about Carlos Beltran's down year was that his start was actually not that bad. So his overall numbers, just to give you perspective on that 2005 season, was a 266 average, a 744 OPS, 16 home runs, and 78 RBIs. Juan Soto is basically on pace to put those numbers up. If you really think about it, like the average is way down, but the OPS is right there. And I just told you he's on pace to go 24 and 75. So I think Soto will have a better year than Beltran. And the answer to your question is absolutely not. Like, if that's Juan Soto's final numbers, that's not a good year. And the fact that his pace is ahead of that and he's having this awful season would tell you that. Now, going back to Beltran, I got to tell you, I don't remember this. I do remember him hitting a home run on opening day and a home run in the finale of their road trip against the Braves. He had a very good road trip in which the Mets lost their first five, won the last game against Atlanta, and then they turned their season around. But Carlos Beltran was hitting over 300 on May 1st. Actually, later than that, he was hitting over 300 on May 21st. Think about that. On this date, we're sitting in late May, so I'll use June 1st as an example. Carlos Beltran was hitting 294 with an 803 OPS. His numbers absolutely dove. They dived, if you will. I guess it's dived or dove in the second half of the season, which leads to what was always said about Beltran, and that's he was playing hurt. And that's what led to his numbers just completely falling off a cliff. In June of that year, he hit 198 with a 644 OPS. So in Beltran's case, it was a good start, and then it went downhill. In Soto's case, it's just been a terrible start for the first 2 months of the season, and I fully expect he's going to get going. I'll give you final numbers right now. I think he'll end up hitting 260. I think he'll end up hitting over 25 home runs. RBIs, I don't know. I think he's going to end up with an OPS over 800. So it may not end up as his best season, but I do think he's going to get hot. When is he going to get hot? Maybe the Rockies this weekend. Maybe Mendy's right about his lower half, and he's impressed by the lower half. Do you share my confidence in Soto breaking out, Hoff?
Yes, and there's a couple things that I look at. Not just, obviously, if you look at April, I think part of the reason why I'm going to tell you this stat, and it's going to be because of how bad he's been, but April's usually his worst month. You know, and whatever, it is what it is. Then you go and look at the rest of his career month by month, like June, July, his OPS in July is like over 1,000 in his career for July. So I'm just saying, like, historically, he's going to get better as the season gets hotter, to be fair. It might be the weather, it could be whatever. But the fact is, his numbers are going to get better. And I think he's really going to catch fire. I'm convinced. 800. I think he's going to be over 850. I think he's going to, he's only finished 853 one time in his career. Everything else was over 900. And this is talking about a guy who had a bad season before and is having a terrible one right now. I'm very convinced that he's going to be above and beyond.
You talk about him having a bad season before. So I want to compare these numbers to get an idea of where he is compared to his worst season. And his worst season statistically was probably 2022. That was the year he was traded to the San Diego Padres. He ended up playing 52 games for the Padres after the trade in 2022. Right now, Juan Soto has played 56 games or 55 games now?
54 games.
54 games?
Something like that.
Yeah, so with San Diego, he played 52. So it's a good apples to apples if you want to look at stats and kind of compare where he's at right now to what he did in that time period with the San Diego Padres. So with San Diego, he had 182 at-bats. Right now, he's got 201. Okay, so very, very similar sample size. With the Padres in 2022, he was hitting 236. Juan Soto right now is at 224. Basically the same. With San Diego, Juan Soto had 6 home runs. Right now, he's got 8. So a little bit ahead of it here with the Mets. With the Padres, he had 16 RBIs. With the Mets, he has 25. The OPS with the Padres, it was 778. With the Mets, it's 745. It is very similar. Now, does that make anybody feel better? I don't know. I'm just giving you the facts that his performance has basically replicated what happened after he was traded from the Nationals to the Padres. Not good. He was being ripped in San Diego. Don't get me wrong. He was hearing boos. But that's – so when we say this is the worst slump of his career or this is the worst 2 months of his career, it isn't true. It's pretty much replicating the 2 months he had late 22 when he was traded to the Padres.
Well, but this is what makes me feel better, Ev, is the fact that that has happened before. 2022 was a bad season. And then what did he do in 23? And what did he do in 24?
Yeah.
I mean, so it's that's the outlier. Okay, it's not great that he's starting his career like that with the Mets, but that means we know what's to come, like you've been saying. So I'm still, no matter what, I'm not going to sit here and get crazy over it. As long as the Mets are winning, long as he's still acting like he's, you know, caring about the squad and caring that he's playing baseball and doesn't get hurt, I'm okay right now.
Just keep winning. And the Mets have won back-to-back series. So, yeah, of course, that's the priority for all of us. We're not Juan Soto fans. We're Met fans. Obviously, him producing helps the team win, but that's the number one priority. Let me get to a few more of your emails. We will then pick the Rico star of the series in our net negative. Bradley writes, Soto slump is starting to concern me. Up until now, I've been taking the measured approach. I know there's a history here with Lindor and Beltran. I understand his track record. And I do still, based on logic, believe he'll be fine in the end. With all that said, what the F? I feel like a kid on his birthday who's opening up all his presents to see all of the boxes are empty. It's strikeout after slow bouncer after strikeout after slow bouncer, rinse and repeat. I'd only been frustrated previously about him, but now at this point, it's finally evolved into a smidge of that word, worried. Dr. Brad. I don't know when I'll be worried. I'd love to put a date on it because a guy called in. It was a Yankee fan. It was a self-admitted Yankee fan. And he said, when will you be worried? And I said, worried about this season or worried about the 15-year contract? And he said the 15-year contract. And I said, next year. I mean, he could complete this season with these awful numbers. And I still wouldn't be convinced it's going to become an awful contract. I'd be convinced he'll bounce back the way a lot of other guys have. He is still young. Now, that may not have been the blood that the Yankee fan was looking for, but in terms of the overall picture, no, even a bad year, I wouldn't be concerned that he's going to be a bust. In terms of this year, like, when does it come to a point where you're like, wow, this is just going to be a bad year? Well, at some point, statistically, it's tough to get out of the hole that you create. I would say, and I'm guessing because I'm not concerned yet, and I'll always be honest here on the Rico that day I come in and say, okay, I'm concerned. Okay, you got me. I'm going to guess probably July would be when I start to worry. Now, Memorial Day is a big unofficial moment in a baseball season. You know, you're a third of the way through the year. Sample sizes start to matter. And I always use Derek Jeter as an example. In 2004, Derek Jeter couldn't hit. And he was having an awful, awful season. Or maybe it was 2003. I always get 03 and 04 Jeter confused. And I went to Baltimore and I'm watching him on the road and he's hitting like 175 and then nobody could get him out. And he ended up finishing the season, you know, with a very respectable batting average. Like he salvaged his season because he finished strong. I think it was 2004. I think I was right about that. And that was when his season started to turn. It started to turn right around Memorial Day. So hopefully that's the case with the Colorado Rockies coming in. Manglehorn writes, not only does Soto F up our team on his last at-bat in a game that's over, he hits a ball and the other pitcher comes up lame. Well, I mean, that's not his fault. He had a slow roller and Miguel Castro came up lame. Nick Stasiak writes, how many more slow choppers to the right do we need to see before trying to switch things up with Soto? His ground ball rate is up 10% from last year. Believe that was shown on either the Fox or ESPN broadcast. Clearly, they've changed his approach, which has led to the mess we're getting. I doubt they've changed his approach. I doubt that all of a sudden, you know, Eric Chavez said, hey, Juan Soto, let's do something different. I doubt that, but they're going to have to try to get him out of this slump. That's for sure. Hey, eventually, Juan Soto will hit one over the fence and we'll all be excited. And, you know, you can knock one out of the park and raise the apple with Takara Chuhai. A sparkling cocktail that blends real shochu spirits with delicious flavors of fruits locally grown in Japan. It's available at Citi Field in Fuji Apple, of course. How can it not be? White peach and lemon. So next time you're at the ballpark, gotta try it. Gotta try it. And you'll enjoy your week or day even more. We got three more games on this homestand coming up. With a Friday night game against the Rockies, a Saturday afternoon game against the Rockies, and then a Sunday afternoon game against the Colorado Rockies. So, the Rico I'm the man now star of the series. What a great question in this three-game series. There are a few people I wrote down as candidates. Brandon Nimmo actually was very productive offensively in this series when it combined 5 for 12. But he did commit that base-running faux pas that took a base hit away from Juan Soto. Honorable mention of Francisco Lindor, too. Because even though Francisco Lindor only went 3 for 14, including 0 for 5 in the finale, he did drive in the game-winning run on Memorial Day. He did play some really good defense, and he did supply a very important insurance run in Game 2 of this series. So honorable mention to Francisco Lindor. Honorable mention to Pete Alonso. Pete Alonso had a hit in every game in this series. 1 for 3 on Monday with great defense. 1 for 4 with a 2-run home run in Game 2. And then 1 for 4 with an RBI in Game 3. So it was a combined 3 for 11 from Pete Alonso. Also, I'll give you another honorable mention. Francisco Alvarez. He went 2 for 5 in this series. Went 1 for 2 in Game 2. Got on base 3 times in that game. And remember, I mentioned this all the way at the beginning of this, Rico. He started the rally in the 8th inning, down 1-0 in Game 1 of this series. The other honorable mention, before I get you to the guy that I think should win, is Reed Garrett. Now, Reed Garrett only pitched in 1 game, but he did come in and get a 5-out save, which is certainly not easy, including getting a big out with a runner on first and 1 out in a game in which the Mets only led by 1. But my vote, and Hoff, this is an up-in-the-air one, so you have every right to try to convince me otherwise. To me, the Rico I'm the Man Now star of the series is a guy that I don't think we had heard of when this season began. Jose Castillo is the Rico I'm the Man Now star of the series. Let me state my case, sir. We go back to Game 1 of this series. The Mets are trailing by a score of 1-0. Okay? It's a 1-0 ball game. And Jose Castillo comes in with a runner on second or runner on first and 2 outs. He battles this pinch hitter, Austin Slater. 11-pitch at-bat, finally gives it and he walks him. Instead of letting that at-bat unravel and turning a 1-0 game into a 2-0 game or a 3-0 game, he strikes out Edgar Quaro in a huge spot, keeping the game at 1-0 and allowing the Mets to come back and tie the game. Following night, Game 2 of this series, there's that man again, Jose Castillo, right after the White Sox made it a 1-run game, comes in. Similar thing. He hits Andrew Benintendi to make things dicey, and he strikes out Edgar Quaro to leave 2 men on base. Did give up an infield hit in the 8th, but then got a big out against Sosa, and he comes out of the game. So, 2 appearances, 2 huge outs, huge strikeouts against Edgar Quaro to leave men on base. And again, considering the other options I gave you, I think Jose Castillo is the Rico I'm the Man Now star of the series.
So, the first guy that I looked at, because I don't think you could sit there and give it to any specific player. Like, I mean, I know Alonso hit a home run. It was nice. Jared Young played every game. So maybe that's someone you can give an honorable mention to as well, because nobody wanted him to play. And he's sitting there playing in all 3 games and actually had an impact in Game 2. I honestly thought it was going to be Reed Garrett, because not only has he just been impressive all season long. He comes in and shuts the White Sox out, down, pitches an inning and a two-thirds. Most relievers, I mean, besides Castillo, didn't see more than 1 appearance. So that's why I thought Reed Garrett was the guy that was deserving, because he's been so lights out. And again, he did the job for Edwin Diaz.
Yeah, I think he's an honorable mention. But you said it, Jose Castillo impacted 2 games.
He did. He did. He's the only one. He's the only one who did that. Even offensively, only got to do it in 2 games.
He impacted 2 games. And again, I started the Rico, and I mentioned this on purpose. Stranding inherited runners is a big deal. And he did it twice. And he not only did it twice, he didn't make it easy. It's not like he came in and just blew people away. First, he has that 11-pitch battle in which he walks a guy. Then he hits a guy. And both times, he strikes out Edgar Quaro and leaves guys on base. I think it's him. You have not convinced me. I love Reed Garrett. I mean, Reed Garrett was outstanding, but to me, the impact on 2 games, the ability to get big outs in both games, one with a 1-run lead, the other spot They're losing 1-0. You give up a second run, it's basically the game is over. Let's not be biased against the guy that even a lot of people still listening aren't familiar with. He's the guy. I'm sorry, it ain't anybody on offense. Though all those guys I mentioned, like Pete Alonso is honorable mention, the home run, the great defense, like it's all fair, had a hit in each game. But I do think it's Jose Castillo, which would make it a relief pitcher. And we have given a relief pitcher this award. Max Kranich won it 3 weeks into the season, or three series into the season. And Waskar Brazoban won it during the Yankee series. So he would become the third reliever to win the Rico I'm the Man Now Star of the Series. And quite frankly, I think he's the winner.
I'll give it to him because, again, he may never have a chance to do it ever again.
It's a good chance that's the case. It could be one and done. I think the net negative is obvious. It's Juan Soto. This will actually be Juan Soto's fourth victory. The fourth time we are making him the net negative of a Met series. I mean, this one's easy. He was 0 for 10. It should have been 1 for 10, but he was 0 for 10. So that's a tough one to get past. So congratulations to Juan Soto. You are the net negative of this series. Isaac writes, Juan Bay. I've had it with Juan Bay. Did the Yankees use and abuse him? If Steve Cohen wanted a mega free agent, why didn't he bid on Aaron Judge or Shohei Ohtani? Thank you for that one.
Yeah, listen, Juan Soto, I got to be honest, like, it's going to keep on happening. And maybe at the end of the season, we'll look back and just have a good laugh at the first 2 months of the season. But at the end of it, I mean, this could be one of the worst seasons ever for a free agent signing with the Mets. I mean, it's quite possible this could be downright the ugliest season we'll ever have. But honestly, Ev, this is the same thing with Francisco Lindor. He didn't start off great. It wasn't great. The first 2 years weren't fantastic. But guess what? He turned the corner, and he's going to be here for 15 years.
Well, that's why there's two differences. There's the, are you concerned about this year? And are you concerned about this just being a disastrous contract? I'm not anywhere near that second one of it being a disastrous contract. As far as this year is concerned, it could be a bad year. I mean, we're sitting here, we're almost about to get to June, and he's at 228 or whatever the heck it is.
Yeah.
So from that standpoint, it could be a concern. Couple of things. Number one, Ronnie Mauricio is tearing it up at AAA. He is destroying it at AAA. And I think he's going to start to put pressure on the New York Mets, especially as long as their offense is struggling, to say, hey, let's call him up and see what we got. But what I'd ask my fellow Met fan, and you can respond to this in the mailbag, thericob@gmail.com, and we'll certainly read some of your responses. If you want to call up Ronnie Mauricio, because he is tearing it up at AAA, because this offense does need a spark, where are you playing him? Because right now, despite our heavy dose of Jared Young, the Mets' best lineup is Pete at first base, McNeil at second, Lindor at short, Beatty at third, Vientos at DH, Nimmo in left, Tyrone Taylor in center, maybe a little bit of Acuna at second with McNeil at center, and Juan Soto in right field. That leaves Starling Marte on your bench. If you call up Mauricio, who's the odd man out? Is it Brett Beatty? Is it Mark Vientos? Is it, no, he's the second baseman, sit Jeff McNeil, or he's the second baseman, go play McNeil in center field. That's probably the likeliest route one would go, because as of right now, I want to see more Brett Beatty. He's been hitting, his defense has been really good, and I also want to see more Mark Vientos. He had a big opposite field home run in the finale of this series. In fact, I've been bothered that Mendy hasn't played him enough, quite frankly. Go back to the opener of this series, he's not in the lineup. And it didn't make any sense to me. Then he is in the lineup in game two, but he's playing third base. Beatty's playing second base so they could DH Jared Young. So I think if you call him up and you send Jared Young back down, where is Mauricio getting the at-bats? Is McNeil losing the at-bats? Is Taylor losing the at-bats? Which route do you go? Colorado series. As of right now, Paul Blackburn is certainly on his way back. Blackburn made a rehab start on Wednesday, so he will be activated next week, and they could insert him in that Dodgers series. I've talked about June 5th being an interesting target date, or at some point in that series, if they want to give guys extra rest, maybe they want to give a Griffin Canning extra rest. So Blackburn could take his day on Tuesday and bump Canning to Wednesday, Peterson to Thursday. But coming up in this Colorado series, David Peterson on Friday, Kodai Senga on Saturday, and then Clay Holmes back on the mound for Sunday's game. And I look at this three-game series now and say, all right, you won two out of three against Chicago. You won the series. Great. I want the sweep now. The Rockies are historically bad. You're at home. This has been a good homestand. 4-2 is good. 7-2 is great. And I remember saying going into this stretch of Chicago and Colorado, you're not going to win every game, but I'd really be happy with 5 out of 6. Well, they're 2-1. So to get the 5 out of 6, they got to take the 3 games against Colorado. Now, let me get to Andy Martino. So last week, I watched a clip of Baseball Night in New York. Sal Licata was on it. Sal did nothing wrong. Sal is not a big DeGrom fan, but I've talked to him about it, and I understand his perspective. He's just not a big DeGrom fan. He loves Matt Harvey, is what it is. So because DeGrom had pitched at Yankee Stadium, they were going around the room talking about what DeGrom's legacy is with the New York Mets. Very innocent question. I'm listening to this thinking, what could you say that's controversial? I want you to take a listen to Andy Martino's answer. I don't know Andy very well, but this reeks of a guy who's got a vendetta against DeGrom. I don't know why. I don't know if there's a personal issue. I don't know what it is. But when fans say they don't trust writers, and Joe used to say this all the time about the writers voting in the Hall of Fame, it's agendas. It's sometimes I'm like, I don't know if there is an agenda. Again, I don't know, Andy. This sounds like an agenda. So I'm done talking. I want you all to take a listen, then we'll discuss it. Here's Andy Martino giving his opinion on Jacob DeGrom's legacy as a New York Met.
Andy, what is DeGrom's Mets legacy?
Well, there's that game five, if we're looking for a positive. I think beyond that, there was a lot of uncomfortable moments, despite the two Cy Youngs. I mean, there was the fact that, he would pitch, go all out, like you said, Dave. Then he would come out of games earlier than the Mets would have preferred their starting pitcher to come out. Oftentimes, he would say that there was a physical issue. Remember, the Mets would always release the next day, like, all the MRI was clean. So, and I remember the time Sandy Alderson revealed that there was some UCL damage, and DeGrom was really upset about that and held his own press conference. I remember DeGrom being upset about his contract that he signed, and I remember him leaving really without a trace. So I think this is somebody who excelled for a brief period in a darker time for the franchise, and the Mets are creating memories that are going to exceed that sometime very soon.
What the F was that? If I'm looking for a positive, what are we talking about? Alvaro Espinoza? Like, I'm looking for a positive. I guess you have game five against the Dodgers. What the F was that? I'm listening to it again. I'm not even getting mad. I'm laughing at how absurd that answer was. If I'm looking for a positive, I guess there's game five. And then, like, he brushed off the two Cy Youngs like it was, and then I had a burger and I went to sleep. Yeah, I won two Cy Youngs and I went to bed. That is, did Jacob DeGrom, like, hook up with Andy Martino's sister or something? Like, what the hell is that about? I think when I first heard this, I got annoyed, and now I'm laughing because that is such an absurd answer to a guy that I'm sure had negative moments here. Like, yes, I remember the disagreement on the MRI or what the injury was with the partially torn UCL with Sandy Alderson. I'm sure at the end there were Met executives annoyed that he was coming out of games early, but that's not his legacy. That's absurd to think it is his legacy. That shows such a disconnect with reality. Like, no Met fan, especially years from now, are going to say, oh, what do you think of Jacob DeGrom? Oh, yeah, he disagreed with Sandy Alderson about an MRI. Come on now. So I don't know what it is. And honestly, I don't even think I want to know what it is. You know, he didn't like him. He didn't give him interviews. He, whatever it was. I don't even know. But that was such an over-the-top response. Like, I guess if you're looking for a positive, we can find that game five, one of the greatest games in the history of the Mets. And then he ends it by saying, there's so much better memories than that. He was, hold on. Let me get this off my chest. Then you go, Pete. He pitched in the World Series. Like, I'd love for the new memories that are so much better than DeGrom to get to that point. Let's not act like Jacob DeGrom was on the 93 Mets. I mean, Jesus Christ. He was on a team that got to the World Series. And by the way, one game one in which he beat Clayton Kershaw and struck out a million guys and then showed balls of steel winning game five. But if you're looking for a positive, I guess we'll include that. But hey, let's get back to him and Sandy Alderson disagreeing on an MRI. That was the most absurd answer I've ever heard.
So let's be serious. Jacob DeGrom would fit in perfectly with this pitching staff right now with the Mets, because going 4 2/3, 5 innings, 5 2, that's perfect. It's right up their alley. But seriously, you're talking about a two-time Cy Young Award winner. You're talking about a guy that barely had more, and I know that wins as a pitcher, losses as a pitcher, what does it really mean? Nothing. But the fact is, how many times did we look at his season stats and go, how is this guy not winning more games? Oh, because the team around him sucks. He was one of the best pitchers in a really bad period of the Mets, but that doesn't mean that he wasn't great and didn't give great moments to the Mets. Yeah, I wish he could have done more. But guess who also, you know, think about this. Compare him to David Wright. Did David Wright have, did he have good moments with the Mets too? He's getting his number retired. The guy went to the playoffs twice. That's it. He's getting his number retired. Did he not have good moments for his career with the Mets?
Jacob DeGrom's going to get his number retired, and Andy may cry. That may really affect him then. It'll happen a long time from now. I don't think it's going to happen next week, obviously. He's still active, and he's had a very good year for the Texas Rangers, and I wish him nothing but the best. But that was a very weird, weird response. Three-game series coming up with Colorado, and then a West Coast trip against the L.A. Dodgers should be fun. Any thoughts, reactions? You can always interact with us, therico@gmail.com. Remember to subscribe to The Rico Bronya, because like I always say, we will give you Rico Bronyas after every series like the one you're listening to now, and we will pop in some instant reactions when you least expect it. Thank you very much for listening and downloading another edition of Rico Bronya.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Rico Bronya podcast. It's amazing, isn't it? Make sure you download it now to keep it on you at all times.